Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight to the Gallipoli Club in Sydney again, this time with Gavin King and Campbell Newman to discuss the recent launch of Can Do, Campbell Newman and the Challenge of Reform, which has recently been released and sold very well. Now, I introduce our two speakers. One of them will be very well known to you, the other to some of you. So we'll lead off with Gavin King, who's the author of the book. Gavin King is a journalist, he's a writer and a corporate consultant. He was a former Member of Parliament based in Cairns and Queensland, an assistant minister in the Liberal National Government in Queensland, which was led by Campbell Newman. And of course, Campbell Newman has a background in the Australian Army. He was opposition leader on the Brisbane City Council and then Lord Mayor from memory for about 7 years. And then there was a brief period in between before he became Premier of Queensland. So what we're going to do tonight is to lead off with Gavin King, and then he will throw to Campbell Newman, and then about half past the hour, we'll go to questions and discussion and finish at the top of the hour. So Gavin King, welcome, and let's start.
Well, thank you. Thanks so much, Jared. What an absolute honour and pleasure to be here. Thanks so much to Jared and to Anne and to the Sydney Institute. Thank you most of all, I think, to everyone for being here tonight. We know how precious everyone's time is in this day and age, so I know that Campbell and I both really appreciate you taking the time in this really historic and quite beautiful venue. So thanks very much. So Can Do, the Campbell Newman story and the challenge of reform. Well, I was a journalist for about 10 years working with News Corporation, various titles in the Northern Territory and Queensland, and in 2011 I got a little bit tired of writing about bad Labor governments, and particularly the one in Queensland. And having written about politicians and bad decisions for a number of years, I decided it was time to put my money where my mouth is, so to speak, and I made the rather mad decision to run for Parliament in the 2012 election. And it was really a big decision for me personally, and one that I didn't take lightly, as no one does when they decide to run for Parliament. But it was really sparked by Campbell. It was really sparked by Campbell making that very audacious bid in early 2011, that decision to run for Premier from outside the Parliament. The Liberal National Party had been stagnating, if you like, for a while in the polls, and it was really Campbell who came on board that was almost a lightning rod to spark interest and to lead the party, and that's what helped me. Certainly his leadership helped me make that decision. So fast forward to 2015, after a term as the Member for Cairns and Assistant Minister for Tourism. I was turfed out, as many of us were, in that election on January 31st. And so, being very suddenly unemployed, I needed a project. It turns out that the subject of the book and the Premier, Campbell Newman, was also suddenly unemployed. And so on the Saturday, 1 week, exactly 1 week after that election, Campbell and I, together with his wonderful wife Lisa, caught up for breakfast in Woolloongabba, a trendy suburb in Brisbane, and we kicked around the idea of writing Campbell's story. And for me, as a storyteller, as someone who had spent, as I said, nearly a decade identifying news stories, identifying stories of interest to people, to me there was a really fascinating story to tell, because Campbell was someone who, in a very short space of time, that 3 years in office, had been really almost an image of Campbell had been built up that was very, very different from the person and the man that I knew and the people who had worked with him for a long time knew. And so when you went, we had people interstate, for example, had an image of Campbell built up that really I thought, was incredibly unfair, was almost a caricature of who that person was. So for me, as a storyteller, there was a fascinating story behind the story, if you like. And, for me, that was the interest in this book. It was about telling a story that really no one beyond his immediate circle of colleagues and staff and friends really knew. I also saw it as a cautionary tale about the personal perils of politics. And so here was a man who was incredibly popular as Lord Mayor of Brisbane, keeping in mind that the Lord Mayor of Brisbane is a very, very big job. There's about 600,000 voters, roughly in a catchment or authority area of about 1 million people. So it's the biggest local government authority in the Southern Hemisphere. And he was incredibly popular for that 7 years. He had approval ratings through the roof. He was the can-do man. In fact, he was voted the world's fifth best mayor in 2010. In a global survey. So for me, the story of this very, very popular political leader who had styled himself almost as an anti-politician, he was there to get things done, and he did get things done. Delivered billions of dollars in infrastructure for the very fast-growing Brisbane area, tunnels and bridges, very green-credentialed mayor and council that he led in terms of planting 2 million trees. And so he's very much a centrist, a politician and an anti-politician. And the story of how this person went from these great heights to in January this year really was dragged down and unceremoniously turfed out of office in very very almost brutal fashion. So to me, there was that story behind the story, but also this cautionary tale about the brutal, often brutal nature and the ups and downs, the rise and fall of this politician. And as a journalist who had written about politicians for a number of years, as someone who was in that combative environment, throwing questions, hurtling questions, bordering on abuse sometimes at politicians, it was fascinating for me to then step on the other side, to become a politician, the very person that I'd spent nearly a decade berating and belittling and giving a hard time for 10 years, and taking those two careers, journalism and politics, and being able to write about a fascinating political character, really was an opportunity that I could not pass up. And Campbell, for me, is a very complex person, and it's slightly strange talking about him as he's sitting here to my left. But he is a very complex character, and as I said, that dichotomy between the perception and the reality of the man for me is fascinating, because he is a very unique leader. And having worked for daily newspaper editors who themselves are quite tough and demanding and often ruthless, I had never worked for a boss like Campbell. So to dig a little bit deeper behind that public persona and really explore his leadership style, talk to people who had known him for a number of years, it was a story that needed to be told. The other aspect of the story and the book, of course, is about Campbell's parents. And Kevin and Jocelyn, as many people would know, certainly Jared knows, having worked with them, were both federal ministers stretching back to the Fraser government in the mid to late 1970s. And his mum, Jocelyn, in fact, at one point was described as the most powerful woman in Australia. She was the highest ranking, at that time, the highest ranking female cabinet minister in the Howard government. And their story, apart from Anne Henderson's wonderful book Partners, their story had also been largely untold. So when we sat down and started talking and interviewing Campbell, interviewing his family and his friends, we really it evolved into what I described as an extended episode of Australian Story, that very popular ABC show on Monday nights. It was the story of a family who had served our nation for a cumulative 40 years, both in the military and, of course, in politics. The crux of the book, though, for me, really is Campbell's relationship with his wife Lisa and his love for his family, his two daughters and his parents-in-law, and how that almost that weak point, if you can call it a weak point, was targeted by the Labor Party in 2011. So the book covers a lot of that history in terms of his parents, in terms of Campbell's army career and his very successful private sector career. But midway through the book, we get to that 2011-12 state election campaign. And for me, what happened to Campbell and to his wife Lisa and her parents, very highly respected, amazing members of the Brisbane community, what happened to them in that election really, for me, is the crux of the book. And it's the cautionary part of this tale. In fact, we've been at events where there have been political candidates in the audience, and we must always warn them not to read the book until after the election, because we fear that they might read particularly certain chapters and decide to not go ahead with their decision to be a candidate. And so for a family who had given so much, particularly the previous 7 years, in 2004, again elected when he was first elected as Brisbane Mayor, for a family to give so much to their community, to be so popular, to have achieved so much, For them to then be dragged down through the mud in what other commentators have described as the dirtiest, the most personal, most vitriolic election campaign in Australian history. For them to be dragged down in that way, and for the impact that lasted for at least 12 months after the March 2012 election. As a member of Parliament in Campbell's team, I certainly had no idea of the personal impact of that 2011-12 campaign and how long it lingered. We talk in the book, interviewed Lisa at great length, and I think very bravely she's spoken about the personal impact, the personal toll on her. There were days when she couldn't get out of bed, particularly in late 2011, when her family and her parents in particular were really being dragged down the mud, being accused by their political opponents of all manner of things bordering on corruption, of benefiting financially from decisions made when Campbell was mayor. All allegations, of course, that were later completely proven to be false and untrue and without any basis. And as a storyteller, that story that no one really had heard, no one really fully grasped, not even those who were in his team really grasped that impact. And when people inevitably ask, as the author, well, what went wrong? How did he go from up here as very popular Brisbane Lord Mayor to really being, quite... this character of a person who was, who was called all kinds of names under the sun. The Courier Mail cartoonist had a little caricature of him as a dressed in almost an SS uniform with a little sort of red bandana with crossed bananas as a squash sticker. I mean, this. How does someone go from this popular position really being dragged down? And I say to them, read Chapter 7, because Chapter 7 explores that 2011-12 campaign. That leads me, I think, or certainly leads the book into the issue of reform, which I know Campbell will talk about in greater depths. But again, as a storyteller and for the book, one of the key interests for me was we all want our politicians to get things done. We all bemoan the fact that politicians are lazy and they claim a big fat wage and they don't do anything. And yet here was a bloke who actually did get things done, whose sole purpose really to be in politics was to take action and to get things done and to make very, very tough decisions, very necessary decisions, but very, very tough decisions. And all of those achievements, all of the things achieved, didn't really count for much because the personality was the number one focus. It was no longer politics today, as evidenced across all levels of government, as we see played out time and time again, particularly on a federal level. The personality seems to be more important than delivery, and more important than action, and more important than policy. And as a relatively young person in my mid-30s, one of my great concerns and one of my I guess passions for writing the book, particularly the section on the challenge of reform, was I hold great fears for people of my generation and younger. We've had 20 odd years of fantastic uninterrupted economic growth, and people of my generation and younger really don't have almost as if we've lost the ability to analyse and to critique and to think more deeply about politicians and politics and the decisions that they make, particularly when it comes to budgets. And when I see what's happening, particularly with social media, and we talk about that a lot in the book, the great concern I have is that people of my age are taking at face value what they see on social media. And so, you know, if Jared Henderson writes a very in-depth analytical article in the Weekend Australian, people of my generation in particular aren't reading that and are not paying attention to it. They're much more likely, and research backs this up, they are much more likely to pay attention what their friend might say on Facebook or their friend might tweet in 140 characters on Twitter. And so when people were Facebooking or tweeting about Campbell Newman, 95% in the negative, that became that echo chamber, and that circle of friends, that circle of social media friends, became the reality. And so the delivery, the policy, the ideas and the action were really lost. And one of the reasons I was very, very keen to do this book was to contribute to the ideas, to try and help further the debate around reform. And I think we are in we're kind of surfing along on a bit of a wave. We're sort of floating around in need of great reform, and yet those topics just aren't being debated and discussed, particularly by people of my generation. And so we quote at the end of the book the great economist Milton Friedman, and we touch on some of his thoughts in that reform section of the book. And he talks a lot about the tyranny of the status quo, which looks at the forces of bureaucracy, of vested interests, and career politicians who really it's in their interest to maintain that status quo. And anyone who tries to take on that status quo, of course, is punished at the polls. And Friedman wrote that in the early 1980s. And yet, in all the work that we did on this book, now Friedman's ideas are even more relevant today. That tyranny of the status quo is just so difficult to break. And when we add in the mainstream media and social media into that mix of vested interests, particularly the unions, of course, but so many others that the Newman government tried to take on, doctors, lawyers, and all the rest, it is just so difficult to reform. To conclude, we finish the book, as I'll finish talking before I throw to Campbell. Milton Friedman said that his goal in publishing books and putting forward these reform ideas were that it was about having these ideas lay around so that when they became politically inevitable, when the time suited those ideas, often when there was a crisis, when there was an economic crisis or some other crisis, those ideas that are laying around become politically inevitable. And that's certainly what we hope happens with this book, that over time, once people look at that reform section and think about the ideas, think about some of the thoughts and ideas that that Campbell will talk about soon, we certainly hope that sooner or later they'll become politically inevitable, hopefully before there's a crisis. So thanks very much, everyone. Please enjoy the book. And thanks again, Jared, for having us. We really appreciate it.
So we're now going to hear from Campbell Newman. Campbell.
Well, thanks very much, Jared, and good evening, ladies and gentlemen. And can I start by thanking Jared and Anne and the Sydney Institute, and thank all of you for your interest in coming along this evening, and also thank the staff and management of the Gallipoli Club for facilitating this get-together. But ladies and gentlemen, I particularly thank you all. I really do. And I thank my author and my former colleague and my friend Gavin King, because, ladies and gentlemen, he's done me a great service, my wife and her family a great service, and indeed my late father and my mother a great service by telling our story. And this evening I really want to cover a few things, and I want to talk obviously about the book, but then talk about some of those matters of reform that Gavin has alluded to. So very quickly, in terms of the book, the reason I particularly wanted to do the book was I wanted to tell my story. As Gavin sort of said, I didn't recognise the person that had been written about and spoken about in the media, particularly over the last 3 years. And I wanted to tell my story. I wanted to set the record straight. Particularly, I wanted to let people know who I was, what I tried to do, why I stood for politics in the first place. We haven't gone on in a sort of particularly in a way about what was achieved, but there is an appendix to the book that you can actually see what I believe are my achievements, both in the Lord Mayoralty and then in my time in George Street in the state government. So I wanted to tell that particular tale. The book is a story, though, about a family, how they came to be in Australia, my antecedents, about my mum and dad's time in politics, the time when Jared was there for a period. Then my time in City Hall and also in the state government. And then, of course, we're reflecting, as Gavin did, on this whole issue of reform. Just to whet your appetite, a few things that we've dug up along the way. No particular order, but just some things that are rather quirky and maybe of interest. For example, my great-great-grandfather came to Sydney in 1854. Hermann Newman, German cook on a Dutch ship, arrived not far away from here in 1854, and very shortly thereafter he married a young Irish girl who was on the same ship, and she was an orphan, orphaned in the potato famine from Dublin, and they then settled in St Peter's, not far from Sydney Airport. So the Newmans were from Sydney for about 100 years, and you'll see a photo in the book, very modest beginnings. My mum's family, on the other hand, came from Melbourne. We found a story of a sea captain, Captain James Mullet, I think it was, who sailed the Pacific in the 1880s and 1890s, and he found that he could catch sea lions. They take those sea lions to the west coast of the States, and he sold them to zoos and circuses, and we found a reference to him in the New York Times in the 1880s saying that Captain Mullet has arrived with another consignment of sea lions. Captain Mullet sailed the Pacific Ocean and caught sea lions. Sadly, we found out, though, that he seems to have abandoned both his wife and his family. But I shall move on. But interestingly, we then find that his grandson, or my grandfather, actually had an early bent for politics too. And he was a solicitor in the city of Melbourne, and he stood for politics in 1952 at the Victorian state election. Interestingly, he found a loophole in the law. He stood for two seats simultaneously in the same election. And we have got a copy of a photo of the how to vote cards as Lynn Mullet stood for those two seats. So that's quite interesting. Moving then to the 1970s, and I think this is an important little tale because, you know, there's no doubt that, Gough Whitlam was, a great man in many ways, but he was also a deeply flawed man. And the history today, I'm afraid, is being written in a way, particularly by the left, which I'm afraid is seeking to airbrush some of the problems out. So what we revealed in this book is something that no one's ever known today, and thankfully Mum's not around to probably refute it. But what I can tell you is that the 1972 election, my father, who was the commanding officer of the 5th Battalion Royal Australian Regiment, invited the local federal member, and this was at Holsworthy here in Sydney, to come and speak about the Labor Party's defence policy. And of course the local member was Gough Whitlam himself. We found a letter, sadly we didn't get into the book, we got a letter, a handwritten note from Gough, dated October 72, thanking Dad for having him and reflecting on some of the things they've talked about. A few weeks later, Dad went into the polling booth and he voted for Gough. And I'm pretty certain that Mum did too. Now, the point I'm making here is that within 2 years, Whitlam and the Labor Party had lost my parents. They indeed were radicalised. They joined the Liberal Party. Dad stood for election at the Bass by-election in 1975. As many of you know, he won that election, a landslide, and later that year, Fraser had the confidence to pull on what happened and became known as the dismissal. I make that point. I think it's an important one in this book because, again, the history is airbrushed today. The Whitlam government caused great problems for this nation and many, many people voted in large numbers to throw them out of office, and that needs to be remembered. So a bit of family history there. In terms of my own political career, why did I stand? Well, I stood, as Gavin said, to get things done. Particularly, I put my hand up to actually deliver infrastructure for the city of Brisbane. Roads, bridges, new buses, we deliver those things. I'm also very proud, though, that we made the decision to restore Brisbane's elegant and beautiful City Hall at a cost of $215 million, when there are many people who said, knock it down. We planted 2 million trees. We moved to only buy renewable energy for the needs of the Brisbane City Council, and that involves something like 4,000 or 5,000 kilometres of roads with streetlights. That was a very big commitment in a practical way to renewable energy. But along the way, I was always planning ahead. And I had been very concerned, even though we were in drought and we had a water supply crisis, I was always very concerned about flooding. And I knew as a civil engineer that Brisbane could flood and would flood again one day. And in late 2010, I was very clear, looking at the BOM and things that were going on, that we would see significant rain. I then said this, and the record will show that I was ridiculed. I was called Chicken Little. Anna Bligh herself came out and had a go at me. They wheeled out public servants to say, what nonsense, Brisbane couldn't flood again. And I should say that Gavin has told the story quite well of why at this stage I had a particularly bad relationship with the Bligh government compared to a very productive one with the Beattie government. Bottom line was, Brisbane did flood. And I guess at that point, it was roll up your sleeves and get into it, make it happen. As Gavin has said, at that time, and I already had been very popular, but at that time I reached the peak of my popularity. Interestingly, the then Premier Anna Bligh also got a big bounce in the polls. And contemplating things in late January 2011, it was very, very clear to me that she would go to an early election, probably by June that year. There was no doubt in my mind. Now, I'd been approached on many occasions to stand for state politics. I had always said no, and contrary to the nonsense that's out there today about me being drafted, I drafted myself. Gavin tells that story about how that happened. I went out and said, I will have a go at this, because I couldn't bear to see a bad Labor government re-elected, a government that had failed to plan for water supply in the same way that they'd failed to plan for flooding, re-elected, a government that had blown the state's finances apart. So I did put my hand up, and we created political history by doing this, by doing the impossible from out of government. I'll make the point, though, that the strong reflection I have on that time and subsequently is always the media felt that somehow this was a non-legit way to go. There was always this sort of resentment and sort of undercurrent about this wasn't right, it shouldn't be happening. And indeed, that was what was transmitted by the Labor Party. As Gavin said, in 2011, we had what others have described as the dirtiest campaign ever. We've told that story frankly and truthfully. We've been, quite open. Indeed, my wife and I have really bared our souls. And I say this evening, it's clear that that affected her, but it also affected me. And I believe it affected my own persona and the way that I dealt with things early in my time as Premier. So I make that confession this evening, as I do in the book. But in terms of what we particularly wanted to say, we then want to reflect on some things that I think are pretty sad and worrying about Australia today. There was no focus during my time as Premier on what we were trying to do. There was no, I think, real belief amongst the Queensland community that Queensland is in the worst financial position. It was then, it is now, of any Australian state. Okay? That realisation has perhaps never been there in the community, and I have to take some responsibility for that. But I can assure you, ladies and gentlemen, we did try. And because of that terrible financial situation, and because of the economic sort of malaise that Queensland was in at the time, we had to make some very important, very difficult decisions. I often used to say to the media, do you think that we would do this? Do you think we'd make this announcement? Do you think we'd put this on the table if it wasn't the right thing to do? We're not silly. We know it's not popular, but it has to happen. But sadly, and I'll reflect in a moment on why, today these sorts of messages don't get transmitted. And I think that's an important thing that we have to say in this book. We had hoped that the media in Queensland particularly would take this on board and faithfully engage in a debate on this. Sadly, they have proven everything that Gavin has said about the role of the media today by failing to deal with the issue. And I say to them, if they're watching this broadcast, don't just believe me. Look at what Paul Kelly said about 4 weeks ago in The Australian. In fact, he said it a few times in recent times. He's saying there is something wrong with political debate and government in Australia today. Five prime ministers in 5 years. The shelf life of governments and political leaders is rapidly reducing. Now, whether you agree or disagree with them all, I don't think the five prime ministers were duds. And yet some people today are trying to suggest that. I don't think, measured to the benchmarks of, say, 50 or 60 years ago, those people were any better or any worse than those people. What I say to you is something has changed. And what has changed, I will now go through. And there are three issues that I put on the table as a way of explanation about some of the things that we're seeing. Firstly, in terms of the media, huge fragmentation. People are not reading newspapers. They're not tuning in necessarily to the TV news. There's a whole variety of entertainment and things that people can do. There are things like Netflix, Fox TV, QuickFlix. People don't have to watch the TV news at all to get entertainment. The scene is incredibly competitive, and I acknowledge that. It's therefore hard to attract an audience, hang on to it, secure that. And then, of course, the huge pile of advertising dollars that they're competing for. And so we see two phenomena that I'll quickly run through this evening. The first one is clickbaiting. And maybe some people have heard of that. Clickbaiting is simply the term used to describe the need for people in the media to try and get the community, the viewer, if you like, to click on a link on a story on their website. They need those clicks because that's how their performance is measured. Advertising dollars relate to the clicks that you get. And so what does that drive? It drives sensationalism. It drives the need to be in people's face to get those clicks. It also, because of this competition and the reduced lead times in stories, means that there is just this intense race to get stuff up. Stories that once upon a time in a reputable publication wouldn't have got up, today are getting up on news websites far more readily. The other thing I want to raise this evening, I'll be very pointed and critical of 7, 9 and 10, is what I call the Big Brother phenomenon. Ladies and gentlemen, my humble opinion, we're getting to the point now there's only one TV show on Australian commercial TV. Okay? What's that show? Well, it's the reality TV show. If I don't know how many people do watch the commercial stations here today, but frankly, I'm switching off myself because the same show is on, the same genre is on all the time. There's the cooking show, it's a competition. There's the renovation rescue show. There's the weight loss show. There's the dance competition, the singing competition. It's all the same thing. There's the good guys and the bad guys, the good girls and the bad girls. You're told to really dislike or indeed even hate the bad people. And you know what you do? You vote them off the show. So if we turn to the TV news, in that precious period of time where people who've got the use of our electromagnetic spectrum, who've had a license from the community, what have they done to debate in this country? Well, they've treated it the same way as these TV shows. And I'll say this now, I'll confront the issue. I've been told by a number of senior people in the media, in the TV media, what do you want about Campbell? It's just entertainment. Well, I'm sorry, that's not good enough. We need a conversation. We need debate. And before I move off the issue of the media, I'll say this, and this may surprise people, because normally conservative politicians belt the ABC. Now, I have particular views on their political bent, but I'll say this. It's only on the ABC, or perhaps Sky News, only on the ABC that there is a forum for the conversation and the debate. And I think the mistake some conservatives have made, and maybe I'm one of those as well, is that we need to engage. On the 7:30 report, on Lateline, even Q&A on the radio shows, you know, we've got to get in there and, you know, and basically step up to the plate and be part of that conversation. If I go to 7, 9 and 10, there's precious little debate, there's precious little conversation. It's a complex, challenging world with huge issues that we face as a community, and yet they're trying to dumb down the news and trying to express things in black and white terms. You know, 10, 15 second grabs, and I'm afraid that isn't doing us any good. I'll be quick because I know we've got to get into some questions, but the two other things I'll quickly touch on social media and also the community themselves. There's no doubt, ladies and gentlemen, that these devices have changed things to a huge degree. I've often said to Jeff Kennett, I've said it a few times, and I don't know if he would agree with me, that I think it would be very difficult today in this environment, more difficult for Jeff to win a second term. And I admired, of course, what his government did. But the use of these devices, the speed at which innuendo, rumour, downright lies and fabrication can travel, the echo chamber effect, the things that Gavin said, really compound the difficulties in dealing with it. There's an old saying about a lie can go, I think it's a halfway round the world, while the truth is only getting their boots on. It was true some time ago, many years ago when that was said. It's even more true today. And I think the big thing is that it is new technology and we don't know how quite to deal with it. We don't know how to filter, and maybe that's something that will come in time. The final point is the one that Gavin touched on, is this issue of the community. 20 years of good times, 20 years of unparalleled growth, and a community that perhaps thinks that politics isn't important, that things will continue to travel on the way they always have, that are benefiting from difficult and challenging reforms of, you know, 30 years ago, but don't realise that those times are probably starting to come to an end. We do have some very big challenges that we face right now, and politics is more important than ever before. We're not seeing the full form of our federation. We're not seeing the proper dealing with an ageing population, fewer people in the workforce. A wave of disruptive technologies like the Internet of Things, nanotechnology, 3D printing, but particularly robotics that is coming to our nation and the rest of the world, that's going to transform the workplace that we need to be gearing up for. Particularly, though, a challenge of unsustainable government spending in health, in welfare, and to a certain extent, education. I say today, quite proudly and unequivocally, more money is not the answer. It's never been the answer. We need better management, we need efficiency, we need to deal with waste and all sorts of problems and overlap and duplication between the federal and the state governments. And we need to deal with bloated and inefficient and non-responsive government. These are things that I do not see people dealing with, ladies and gentlemen. They must be dealt with. My final point on this issue is, to be rather pointed, I'm very disappointed, indeed dismayed, when I hear the debate these days, particularly with some Conservative leaders now getting in saying we need to increase the GST, we need to broaden the tax base, we need to fiddle with superannuation yet again. I thought Conservatives were for smaller, more efficient government, not more taxes dressed as somehow up as reforms. And I repudiate that, as I always did. I'm on the record as Premier as rejecting an increase to the GST, and I wish some people at senior level in our state and federal administrations would start to work harder for us to actually save money rather than to asking to put their hand in our pocket once more. Just to wrap up, it's been fantastic to do this book. As I said at the beginning, it's about to tell your story, to be able to describe what your motivations were all about, to put some amusing family anecdotes on the table, but particularly leave something behind so that people really did know, particularly your own family, what you're all about is a great privilege. I will be forever indebted to Gavin King for being my biographer. I thank him most profusely for that great privilege of the time and effort that he's put into it. And ladies and gentlemen, I thank you again for coming this evening. And I hope that you enjoy the book. In fact, I'm very confident that you will do so. And thank you, Jared.
Many thanks to Gavin King and Cameron Newman. And so we come to question and discussion. Before we do, Janet Grundy, who's our bookseller, Can Do, Cameron Newman and the Challenge of Reform. We've got some copies of that. And I'm sure the authors would be happy to sign it after. You couldn't buy it in one commercial bookshop in Sydney because they didn't like Mr. Newman's politics. It wasn't published by the taxpayer-subsidised University of Queensland Press because they didn't like Mr. Newman's politics. But you can buy it at the Sydney Institute. Now, the price is $29.95, and today we've got a special offer here for cash for $30, which is quite an offer. We always make a gesture at the Sydney Institute because we're bereft of change. Change, yes. We don't have change. Now, if I can get Gavin to come up here and stand over here, and Campbell to stand here, and then I'll get out of the way in a minute. So I just lead off. Now we've got about 20 minutes. Okay, so just going back, the decision you made to give up the job as Lord Mayor of Brisbane, which is a very big and influential council on world standards, to then to take sort of a gap year as you prepared to go into politics. But it always seemed to me that it wasn't well rewarded by the new Liberal National Party because they offered you a seat which was always marginal, and even if you had won the election, the chances of you holding that seat in any normal election would have been very unlikely. So why were you offered a seat that was so difficult to hold, and why did you accept that offer?
Jared, I'm glad you asked that, because I'm afraid I must dispel so your thoughts that the LNP somehow did the wrong thing by me. The bottom line was, that's the seat I stood for. That's the seat I put my hand up because it was my community. Lisa and I had met at the Noggar Army Barracks, which is in the electorate. We'd been married there. Our firstborn was christened there. We lived there for 10 years in Warmington Road, Ashgrove. We still bank at Westpac, Ashgrove 4060. You wonder why I'm going on about this, but you'll know in a moment. The point was, it's our community, and we're still involved in that community. We live about 2 kilometres from the border. The point was, I wanted to serve my community, the area we were comfortable in. The other thing is, I knew it was a difficult seat. And my attitude was that if I wanted the team to really try hard in 2011 into 2012, that I had to set an example. You know, I went there again to do what was right, not to be after a sinecure or a safe seat or, you know, a hammock. I wanted to be there to actually lead the team and show what needed to be done, and that's what we did. One reflection I make, which was unfortunate and made it very difficult to hold that seat, was on the very first day after I announced my candidacy, essentially a certain journalist at the Courier Mail, we name in this book, said, ha ha, he never lived there, and made me illegitimate. Now, ladies and gentlemen, the reason I'm making the point, going back to social media, is I never managed to deal with that. I believe there was an element in my electorate who believed that I was some sort of foreigner or a carpetbagger, even though we had that track record in history. So I'm answering your question, but I'm also making the point about how some of these things these days will stick and never go away, and poor journalism leads to, again, that's just one little chink in the armour, that's one little thing on a long road throughout 2011 that has eventually took me down. It's a case study, this book, in some ways. It's a case study in how to take a popular political leader down.
Thanks. We'll get it here. Yeah.
Mr. Newman, in this country, you don't own what's under the ground. So I'd like to raise the question of coal seam gas issue with you. You might own what's under the ground, but it's a basic principle of liberalism, property rights, and also liberal classical democracies, I suppose. How do you reconcile, therefore, the competing demands between private property rights and the need for state revenue? Because that was clearly a problem in your state and maybe a factor in your demise.
In terms of the issue...
So just for people down the back, it's a question about coal seam gas and property rights.
Okay, well, I guess for a long time in Queensland, those property rights were taken away, so it predates us by many, many decades at least. So that actually wasn't really an issue in our election. There's a chap here in Sydney, you may have heard him, he's called Alan Jones. He is a factor in how the election played out, but it's a rather complex one to explain in that he made a lot of noise during the election campaign, the lead-up to the election campaign. He certainly prevented us from getting our message out night after night on the TV news because he'd said something outrageous that I always had to answer. So it didn't matter to the media that I was announcing some positive initiative on the back of some of the great reforms, for example, in our hospitals. But the point is he distracted. Now, in terms of the areas where coal seam gas and coal mining activity is occurring in Queensland, let me just rattle off the seats that were affected. Toowoomba North, Toowoomba South, Condamine, Warrego, Gregory, Nanango and Southern Downs. We won every single one of those seats. In fact, one of the seats was Condamine, which we won back from the Katter Party. So I say to all of you, ladies and gentlemen, and I say to Alan Jones, I hope you're watching, Alan, coal seam gas is not an issue in Queensland. You've tried to make it an issue, Alan, but it's not, and people get the benefits, and my government particularly reconciled the issue of the conflict between farmers and the coal seam gas, you know, miners, if I can put it that way. So we actually sorted that issue out, and I think it's going to be a great growth industry for Queensland. Unfortunately, Mr. Jones has created a mood, I think, in New South Wales, where New South Wales is going to have very expensive gas soon. So, you know, people are, this state have got a real problem ahead of them, both for industry and people in their homes, when the price of gas spikes. But I know what he's going to do. He's going to blame Queensland for exporting gas.
Okay, so we've got a question down here. Yep.
Hi, Mr. Newman. Just want to go back to the media cycle.
Yep.
I'm chairman of the British Conservative Party, Conservatives of all, so this is something we deal with from a conservative perspective all of the time. It is true that it's a changing face of media, 24-hour news cycle, sound bites rather than long discussions. But that's the way the world is. That's the way the world is moving to. And recently in politics, with Mr. Rand moving on, there seems to be a lot of blame at journalism and lazy media. That may be the case, but that's where we are now. So my argument would be, isn't it about our politicians being better at communicating, being better about getting their points across in the way that the news cycle now is? It was something, it is now something else, it will become something else.
The suggestion is that the problem is not so much the media, but the inability of politicians to get their message across.
Yeah. Well, look, I think that's a legitimate point to put forward to challenge me, and the media would do that. But I say to you that, well, it's more the way things are presented. We got great support from the print media, okay? So I don't want people to misunderstand what I'm saying. So in the 90 days prior to the election, I think the record would show that the Courier Mail editorialised at least twice, maybe three times, the Sunday Mail at least once, the Australian and the AFR all said this: good government, strong government, right policies, re-elect them. In fact, I think around the December the 14th, the Courier Mail were very strong. But that's not what the electronic media said. So, you know, I could go out every day and do my darndest to try and sell the message and what we're doing. But if people don't want to cover it, then there's a big problem. Let me give you an example. Myself and Lawrence Springborg, who's arguably one of the best health ministers the nation's had in the last 30 years because he turned around Queensland's hospitals, and I went out to announce that something like 12,000 at least older people who were waiting to get their cataract and glaucoma consults would be seen and operated on within about 8 months. We made that announcement. So I thought that was fairly newsworthy, given that we'd cut hospital waiting lists and improved emergency departments' waiting times. Well, what got on the news that night? Well, I'll tell you what got on the news. That was the day that Clive Palmer said Campbell Newman has a mental health problem. He hasn't taken his medication. Well, our announcement didn't make the news. So, you know, I believe 40 years ago, if Clive Palmer or a figure like that had ranted and raved and said these things, that decent journos would have gone, that's nonsense, we're not even going to dignify that by putting it on the news. That's not where we are today, because it's entertainment and they want to show it and they will show it. And, you know, the Prime Minister is saying that he wants to have a conversation and so far he's doing well. We'll see how it goes. Good luck to him. I hope he's right. I hope that maybe some of the things I'm saying are wrong, but I fear that I'm actually going to be proven right. Mm.
And can I just say, sorry, Jared, just quickly, you're right, politicians do need to change and they don't escape blame or scrutiny in the book. And I think Mike Baird, of course, is held up as the paragon example of how to communicate with the media. But I think the trick today, which Campbell either didn't do or didn't get at the time, was that they have to like you. So if journalists like you and they like Malcolm Turnbull and they like Mike Baird, and that likability is reflected in the way that they transmit the news. So absolutely agree, politicians do need to change. The trouble is that reform isn't happening. So while Mike Baird is fantastic live tweeting The Bachelor and, you know, riding to work in a DeLorean for Back to the Future Day, hard decisions, necessary decisions aren't being made.
Right, there's a question over here. Okay, there was a question here.
Yeah. Thank you. David Paul.
I'll just come back to the middle.
This isn't an issue that I think you haven't addressed. I think you have addressed in government, but it's one that's important for me, and I don't think it's been completely answered through no fault of your own, but Heiner, the Heiner Inquiry. I think there's...
Well, hang on, that's a bit complicated for here. There's a question about the Heiner Inquiry, which is...
I was going to specify public service corruption.
Okay, so maybe you could explain.
The Heiner Inquiry goes to this allegations, well, not allegations, the documents that were shredded years ago by, I think, the Goss cabinet, wasn't it? Look, we looked into that. I mean, you know, probably the best way to put it is, you know, if there was something there, we'd have been right on it. I mean, you know, politics is politics, but the way we saw it, there wasn't. And my former Attorney General, Jared Blair, had a really good look at that. There are many people who still have still raised it, but we did give it a good look and we just couldn't see that there was anything there that we could tackle.
OK, there's a question down the back. Yeah, and then we go here. Yes?
So, Campbell, John Burton, former employer of City Council. We had a great time there with Vision. Every time, I remember you going out, every time you went to public... being pulled that high, you spent a lot of time doing the negative stuff, and then there was a groundswell leading up to the Queensland plan. Do you have some regrets that didn't ever reach its maturity?
Are you talking about the Queensland plan, are you?
Yeah.
Okay. So, ladies and gentlemen, what we actually engaged in probably in the last, 14, 18 months was an exercise to create a 30-year plan for Queensland. And the way we did it was to engage people across the state. We had 80,000 people have their say. We had a forum in Mackay, then we had a very big one in Brisbane, and we had representatives for every electorate with their MPs involved in that. The bottom line is we created a plan which I think is a blueprint for Queensland's future. I will say this candidly this evening, I don't think, well, certainly the Labor Party didn't get it. I don't think some of our own people got it too, did they, Gavin? But if I was there, we would be continuing to implement it. And I'd say to the LNP state opposition, the best thing they've got going for them is they've got that document. They were all involved in creating it. It is a blueprint for the state. It wasn't a talk fest. It's about real things that the state needs to achieve, and they should grab it and run with it and take it to the next election as serious content that the community have signed on to.
Gavin, do you want to comment on that? Okay, so there's a question here. Yeah.
I agree with a lot of the points you've made today and the challenges the media brings just in what it presents and how good policy is hard to get through. However, on the other side, what do you think about political parties, you know, producing these career politicians as opposed to people who are in touch potentially more so with...
Well, good question. Well, that's a really good question. I guess that's... I wasn't the career politician. I was someone who wanted to get things done. And I guess the tale we're telling is, look, you know, well, who do we want? Do we want people who are out there with the selfies and the sort of the popular stuff and not telling it like it is? I mean, the former editor of the Courier Mail, Mr. David Fagan, has said that I was a poor premier. He classes me as a poor premier because I didn't get the politics right, because I lost. What I say to him is, well, I guess by definition you're correct in terms of didn't get the politics right, but I certainly talked about the right government policies and the right programs and what was required. We did do something extraordinary. We actually, in the 13-14 financial year, as I understand it, did something no other Australian government's ever done since World War II. We actually spent less in the 13-14 financial year than we did in the 12-13 financial year. Now, that's good government. It was required. It's good for the Queensland kids and their grandkids who've got to deal with the debt that's been accumulated. We had to step on the pedal. But I tell you what, it's difficult, hard politics. And I say to the Mr. Fagans of this world, do you want good government or good politics? Well, I stand for good government every single time. And I'm sorry that the media in Queensland were more interested in good politics.
This question down the back.
Your military career and engineering career, how helpful was that to you in politics?
The question about that, is this provided by your military and
engineering. Well, yeah.
Military career and what career?
Engineering
career.
Well,
right.
it was very much about getting things done. It was particularly helpful in local government, because we did have a big infrastructure program, billions of dollars worth of investment, and sort of the skills I learnt in that about getting things done, about getting organised, were all very helpful. I think it was also a liability in that, and Gavin has sort of, I don't know if you, did you write this in the book? I can't remember. We'll say it this evening. I mean, one time during the Bundaberg flood, there's this couple there, and they're upset, their home's been flooded, and I've walked up to them and I'm there trying to comfort them. So I'm there telling them what we're going to do to fix up, the clean up the street and help them with their house and all that stuff. So I'm going through the shopping list of things, and more. And one of my ministers was watching on TV back in Brisbane going, just give them a hug, Campbell. And I didn't. I wasn't into hugging strangers. Maybe if I'd hugged more strangers, I'd still be the Premier today.
That's
a big lesson. By the way, ladies and gentlemen, one thing I just want to reflect on, I was pretty hurried in my talking this evening, but you know, there's lots of true confessions in this. You know, so we're not just saying the media are to blame. I mean, there's lots of quite raw admissions of failure. But you know, there are some other bigger picture things as well, apart from my transgressions. One other thing on the military thing, though, which I again want to reflect on this evening is, time and time again, my military service was used as a negative against me by the Labor Party. So negative military stereotypes were actually used to convey certain images about me to the community. And I believe they tried to do the same thing to the new member, Mr. Hasty, from over in WA. He suffered the same thing. So I find it hypocritical. You can't turn up on Anzac Day, wrap yourself in the flag and talk about our glorious servicemen and women, and then use negative military stereotypes. So I saw that over 10 years in politics from the Labor Party.
And just to finally for Gavin, I think it's a nice spot to end. For Gavin, what was your experience going from, I mean, Mr. Newman went from engineering in the military into local government, then state government. You went from a newspaper into politics, but how different is it between sitting there at the 10 o'clock news conference and working out what's got to be done and actually doing it?
So much easier. So much. It's far easier to complain and write about a problem than it is to try and address it. But fascinating for me, you know, Jared, I would stand at a press conference next to this bloke and he would try and explain, and you know, I would look at the journalist and think, why don't you ask him about the policy or the idea? And perhaps I didn't do that when I was a journalist. But one of the great quotes that Campbell said to me very early on after our election was that, you hate the person you were, don't you? You hate the person you were. I kind of agree with him, but anyway.
Well, look, many thanks to both of you. As I said, Jenna Grundy's got copies of Can Do, Campbell Newman and the Challenge of Reform. As Mr. Newman pointed out, I work for Kevin Newman, and Anne and I were good friends of Kevin Newman and Jocelyn Newman. In fact, when Mr. Newman was Premier of Queensland, I used to say my brush with fame was that I'd once worked for the Queensland Premier's father, which was useful to me at the time. I think what's important about this book is it acknowledges success, which is correct, and it acknowledges errors. It's not a self-serving book that Gavin King's written in cooperation with Campbell Newman. It's a very honest and frank book. I think it's a very useful book because I think in recent times we've had a lot of self-serving analysis by politicians and former politicians in Australia and elsewhere. This is not a self-serving book. It's a very honest book, and I think it will do well. I'm very pleased that Connor Court picked it up. I believe the University of Queensland Press should have published it. I believe Brisbane Bookshop should sell it. But at any rate, it's selling well, and you can buy it here, and it's been a successful publication. So well done to the author, Gavin King.
Thank you so much.
Yes. And well done to the club.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.